From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
For War News Radio at Swarthmore College, I'm Amber Sheth. This year, we're introducing some changes to our show structure. Now, you can look forward to listening to thought-provoking investigative journalism every week from War News Radio. The Iran nuclear deal is a topic that has been all over the news recently. But how much do you really know about the deal and what it entails? Ava Sheffi has the details.
President Obama this month secured the votes necessary in Congress to ensure that the Iran nuclear deal will be adopted in October. The nuclear deal, or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was negotiated between Iran, the United States, China, Russia, France, Germany, and the UK. The deal was negotiated over the course of the past 9 years and is a landmark victory for the president's foreign policy agenda. The core of this deal is premised on the gradual easing of economic sanctions against Iran in exchange for the elimination of Iran's key pathways to building a nuclear weapon. Iran will have to reduce its stockpiles of enriched uranium and its number of installed centrifuges, as well as discontinue efforts to produce weapons-grade plutonium. The deal also includes transparency measures that allow 24/7 monitoring of Iran's nuclear facilities, with a maximum of 24 days to resolve disputes that could arise over access. There are also provisions ensuring the snapback of sanctions if Iran fails to comply. Congress was given 60 days to review the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action after it was endorsed by the United Nations Security Council. During this time, the political debate within the United States was particularly divisive and often characterized by myths and hyperbole. Many of the deal's opponents claimed the nuclear deal was unenforceable and that it would create a clear pathway to aggression for an expansionist and anti-Semitic nation. Many supporters, meanwhile, asserted that the deal would bring in a new era of prosperity and openness for Iran. While current evidence suggests that neither extreme is likely to be correct, it will be impossible to assess the deal fully until its implementation begins next month. Most of the coverage of the deal in the United States has focused on the plan's potential effects on Israel and the effort to block its adoption, largely led by the Republican Party. It is estimated that well over $50 million were spent on advertisements and lobbying, both for and against the deal. Sources estimate that the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, for example, spent close to $40 million in an effort to sway public opinion and congressional support against the deal. But while the domestic cleavages created by the nuclear agreement have received extensive coverage in the United States, very little attention has been paid to the social, political, and economic dynamics surrounding the deal in Iran. While American public opinion was largely divided on the deal, many Iranians celebrated its passing. According to a recent report by the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran, the lifting of economic sanctions has given people hope for economic recovery. The highest cost imposed by the sanctions is paid by the people, particularly the low-income and vulnerable groups, says activist Fakhro Sadat Mohtashamipour. In addition to economic upturn, some Iranians look forward to social reforms. An anonymous journalist said if the deal failed, the atmosphere for cultural activities and journalism would become tremendously more difficult as domestic security organs would pressure the media and journalists in order to silence any voices of dissent. Others believe the deal's passing would allow President Hassan Rouhani to turn his attention to issues of human and civil rights, which he emphasized in his candidacy. While some are hopeful for improvement, a significant number of Iranians are also skeptical of the government's ability to enact change. Despite this, the report found strong support for the nuclear negotiations and hope for an agreement was unanimous and unequivocal, no matter what was expected out of the deal. Iran's domestic politics have also played an important role in the country's reaction to the deal and will impact future enforcement. Much like the United States, Iranian political opinion was largely divided into hardliners, who oppose any negotiation with the United States, and moderates, who want an opening of diplomatic and economic ties with Western powers. The current president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, campaigned as a reformer, and the prospect of the negotiations has already increased his popularity. Currently, the Iranian legislature, the Islamic Consultative Assembly, is controlled by conservatives. Upcoming elections in the February of 2016 present the opportunity for Rouhani's allies, the reformists, to gain a legislative majority, which gives him a strong incentive to pass and implement the deal effectively. Another important consideration is the intersection of domestic culture and politics in Iran. Issues of dignity and gender played significant roles throughout the talks. Iranian politicians often use gender terms such as namus, which refer to the weaker female side in a romantic or platonic relationship. And the entrance of foreign agents into Iranian domestic politics may have been interpreted as a possible threat to namus. On the other hand, political leaders who supported compromising with foreign powers pointed to the idea of heroic flexibility, known as narmesh and sazesh. No small part of the Iranian domestic reaction to the deal has been in response to its potential economic effects. The US and European Union-imposed sanctions have had significant negative impact on the Iranian economy since they were tightened in 2012. Iran's oil exports have declined by about 1 million barrels a day since that time. Inflation skyrocketed, particularly for essentials such as food and fuel. The sanctions also included an embargo on companies that provided credit and insurance to Iranian industries, and many other domestic industries suffered from difficulties in importing parts and materials. Unemployment spiked to an estimated 10.3%, and Iran's GDP shrunk by about a fifth. Although Iran has the 18th largest economy in the world and the second largest stock exchange in the Middle East, it has struggled to attract foreign investment. According to the World Bank, under the proposed deal, Iran will be able to sell an estimated 30 to 40 million barrels of oil that it had previously stockpiled, with a corresponding $3 billion increase in foreign direct investment in the short run alone. This increase in global oil supply will also lower crude oil prices by $5 to $15 per barrel. Allowing Iran to open up its economy to the wider world could have implications for consumer and labor markets as well. As of summer 2015, a full quarter of all Iranians with postgraduate degrees live outside of the country. This brain drain has led to a $50 billion loss for the Iranian economy. International oil companies, American healthcare providers, and aviation companies like Boeing and Airbus have sought investment opportunities in Iran, but have been turned off by the latest round of sanctions. While the proposed deal continues to be a source of fierce political controversy within American domestic politics, one of the main arguments made by supporters of the deal has been that, should the deal collapse, other signatories would remove sanctions regardless, and the US could not continue constricting Iran's economy on its own. Many European countries, in particular, are looking for investment opportunities with Iran. At the end of July, France's foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, visited Iran, hoping to establish closer ties as well as create business opportunities. A delegation of 100 French business leaders is scheduled to visit Tehran, and German and EU officials have taken trips to Iran this past summer as well. Meanwhile, in Iran, many leaders see multiple advantages in this détente. Not only may increased diplomatic and economic ties be beneficial in themselves, but they will also make it much more difficult to re-isolate Iran economically if a future US administration chooses to do so.
This is War News Radio. Secretary of State John Kerry gave a speech defending the Iran nuclear deal on September 2nd. War News Radio's Joelle Hajboutros was there and shares her thoughts about the speech.
On September 2nd, I had the privilege and the honor of attending U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's speech in Philadelphia regarding the Iranian nuclear deal. Kerry spoke to a small group of around 100 students, politicians, activists, and religious figures in an intimate setting at the National Constitution Center. His speech was seen as a last-minute appeal to opponents of the deal before it was put to a congressional vote in the following weeks. Minutes before the speech was about to begin, news agencies announced that Senator Barbara Mikulski, a Democrat from Maryland, pledged her support for the deal, becoming the 34th senator to do so. This essentially guaranteed the deal to pass in case of congressional rejection of the plan. It would provide a legal basis for President Obama's promise to veto a rejection of the plan. In spite of this news, whether released coincidentally or purposefully in conjunction with a speech, the program continued as planned. Secretary Kerry's speech was preceded by a brief introduction from former Republican Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Richard Lugar. The senator's successful experience developing legislation on Soviet nuclear disarmament deals gave him the authority to say that while, quote, there is no perfect nuclear agreement, the Iranian deal is one that the American people should support. When Secretary Kerry took to the stage, he made clear his intention to set the facts straight and to dispel damaging myths surrounding the contents and implications of the nuclear deal. Kerry began with a reminder of the gravity of the situation before the negotiations started in 2013. Acknowledging that the strict multilateral sanctions regime the U.S. painstakingly constructed had failed to prevent Iran from becoming a, quote, nuclear threshold state, Kerry insisted that the next logical step was to pursue diplomatic negotiations. He argued that the joint plan of action reached in Geneva in 2013 and the accord that followed in July of this year was able to stop Iran's nuclear program from any further dangerous progressions.
It accomplished diplomatically what sanctions alone could never have done or did.
Kerry's clear-cut language throughout the speech aimed to rationalize support for the proposal as an obvious choice for security and stability. He conjured up a terrifying image of world security without the deal.
We can sum up by saying that without this agreement, the Iranians would have several potential pathways to a bomb. With it, they won't have any.
He assured listeners that Iran's facilities would be under constant surveillance. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency that monitors the peaceful use of nuclear energy, would forever have complete access to Iranian nuclear sites. He also warned that sanctions can, quote, snap back into place if Iran violates the treaty. Kerry also addressed politicians against the deal who claimed the U.S. should return to the drawing board in order to secure a more favorable agreement.
So just apply your common sense. What do you think will happen if we say to Iran now, hey, forget it, the deal is off, let's go back to square one? How do you think our negotiating partners, all of whom have embraced this deal, will react? All of whom are prepared to go forward with it, how will they react? What do you think will happen to that multilateral sanctions regime that brought Iran to the bargaining table in the first place? The answer is pretty simple. The answer is straightforward. Not only will we lose the momentum that we have built up in pressing Iran to limit its nuclear activities, we will almost surely start moving in the opposite direction. It is hard to conceive of a quicker or more self-destructive blow to our nation's credibility and leadership, not only with respect to this one issue, but I'm telling you across the board, economically, politically, militarily, and even morally.
In the next part of his speech, Kerry dispelled three major myths surrounding the deal. The first is that the deal is based on trust with Iran. The secretary countered this by reminding us of the fact that sanctions relief is dependent on Iranian compliance with the accord. He then reiterated the extensive enforcement and survey mechanisms set in place to ensure Iran sticks to its end of the bargain. Understandably, Kerry is addressing an audience highly suspicious of Iran, and these reservations are legitimate to an extent. Yet by continuing to implicitly label Iranians as untrustworthy, unpredictable, less moderate, and as regional destabilizers, Kerry does little to change the prevailing, fear-inducing discourse of a diabolical Iran. His comments also seem to belittle the positive future implications the deal could have on U.S.-Iranian relations. Next came the traditional reference to Israel and America's reaffirmed commitment to ensuring Israel's security. I expected nothing less than what happened. An emotional appeal to Israel followed by a typical conciliatory gesture of more U.S. military support packages. if, as Kerry argued, the deal is the best means to ensure the security of Israel, as well as the Gulf states, why then the need for increasing U.S. military packages to equip these countries with more weapons? The irony of this announcement should not be understated. The second myth Kerry dispelled is that the deal would make Iran's path to a nuclear weapon legitimate. This was easily answered by drawing the distinction between legal civilian nuclear programs and illegal programs aimed at developing a nuclear weapon. The deal targets the second of the two, and ensures that Iran will not develop a nuclear weapon. While Kerry admitted that some of the additional restrictions would ease after a decade or more, he argued that it would be illogical to reject the deal on that basis.
My friends, it just doesn't make sense to conclude that we should vote no now because of what might happen in 15 years, thereby guaranteeing that what might happen in 15 years will actually begin to happen now.
The third myth Kerry debunked was that Iran could still be able to build a nuclear facility with the deal in place because the agreement requires a maximum of 24 days for international observers to reach an area of suspicious nuclear activity. Kerry effortlessly crushed this belief by pointing out that nuclear fissile materials cannot be easily eliminated or removed in that brief time window without leaving almost permanent traces. Kerry concluded his speech by reiterating that in walking away from the treaty, the multilateral sanctions will crumble, Iran's nuclear activities will recommence, and pressure will increase for U.S. military action to eliminate Iran's nuclear programs.
At that point, we won't have the world behind us the way we do today. Because we rejected the fruits of diplomacy, we will be held accountable for a crisis that could have been avoided, but instead, we will be deemed to have created. So my question is, why in the world would we want to put ourselves in that position of having to make that choice, especially when there is a better choice, a much more broadly supported choice, the choice that sets us on the road to greater stability and security, but that doesn't require us to give up any option at all today?
Ultimately, Kerry's Iran speech served as a stern warning to opponents of the nuclear deal. In my opinion, it was a very standard speech that served a specific and necessary purpose of convincing Congress and the American people of the necessity of the nuclear deal. While it was obviously targeted towards a conservative audience, from which the main opposition stemmed, some of the rhetoric used and assurances made to U.S. regional allies appeared to be hypocritical and unprogressive, which in fact takes away from the accomplishment of the deal itself. Now, with the last of the congressional opposition to the resolution soundly defeated, the Obama administration's extensive publicity campaign in favor of the historic deal, including this speech among many others, can ultimately be deemed a success. For War News Radio, I'm Joelle Hajboutros.
That's our show for this week. War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College. Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter to keep up in between shows. Our behind-the-scenes crew includes Tyler Welsh, Anita Desai, Jay Clayton, and Catherine Kwok. This show was produced by Leo Elliott. I'm Amber Sheth. Until next time, thanks for listening.